Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Surface. I'm Brian Levinson. I created this podcast because I love to utilize the power of story to find out how people have developed their mindset for performance. We talk with CEOs, coaches, athletes, actors, really anybody who considers himself to be a performer to gain a better understanding and perspective on how these people see the world. The goal is to dig deep with each person and find out about their mindset. We'll learn about their successes, their failures. The goal is to uncover great pieces of information that hopefully can help you as you continue to create your own journey. We'll talk with people at the beginning of their journey, those in the heart of their career, and those who are able to reflect back on the career that they've had. We are all a compilation of the stories that we hear and the stories that we tell ourselves. So as you listen, it's important to think about how these themes relate to your journey as you go beyond the surface with yourself as well. I'd like to welcome Alan Stein Jr. to the Beyond the Surface podcast. Alan is someone who I reached out to years ago when I was first getting started to get his perspective on the Washington, D.C. sports landscape. At the time, he was working with DeMatha, their basketball team. And DeMatha, for those of you that don't know, is one of the most historic basketball programs in the country. And so I reached out to Alan, and he was so gracious with his time and really just gave me his perspective on how he built his business and what he's trying to do in the future. And that conversation was terrific. So when I launched this podcast, I said, hey, I'm going to reach back out to Alan and see if he would come on. Alan's a basketball performance coach. He's really based in strength and conditioning. But as you'll hear in our conversation, he really thinks about himself from a performance standpoint. He's a speaker. He runs a great podcast. If you follow him on Twitter, you know he's super active there. He spent the past 15 years working with all kinds of elite athletes, everyone from Kevin Durant to Victor Oladipo, and he's worked with just a number of terrific basketball players. He's a high-energy guy. You'll hear that in his conversation today. We go back and forth. It's pretty seamless, and he's someone who really focuses on leadership and culture and how do you cultivate leadership and culture to develop mental toughness. He is an inspirational guy. He'll share his story and his journey. He'll share some of the highs and lows that he's had throughout his career. And he'll really give his perspective on what it means to perform and to perform greatly. So without further ado, I'd like to present to you Alan Stein. As we go beyond the surface, I encourage you to go beyond the surface with yourself as well. Alan, why don't you start? Just tell me about your upbringing. What was life like for you as a kid? And we'll go from there.
Absolutely. Very fortunate to have tremendously supportive parents. Parents that wanted to provide as many opportunities for me as possible, which when I was young mostly revolved around sport. I played just about every sport and did just about every physical activity, from martial arts to BMX biking to skateboarding to your more conventional soccer, football, basketball. And both of my parents were educators. They were both elementary education teachers. And so I always had a very high value for education and always had people model to me what it's like to really love your job and to do something that you find very fulfilling. Of course, I didn't realize that when I was younger, but to have that upbringing, I was very thankful. So I grew up with a lot of love and a lot of support and two folks that modeled a great work ethic and doing what you love.
Were they active? Because it sounds like you were a pretty active little guy.
They were not necessarily physically active. I've never even seen my parents exercise outside of taking walks right now, but they were unbelievably active in our lives and present in our lives and making sure that I have a younger brother, making sure we were at everything we needed to be. So as you can appreciate as a parent, just jockeying kids around from activity to activity keeps you pretty active in and of itself.
And then brother, how old's brother?
My brother Jeremy lives down in Jacksonville, Florida. He's 3.5 years younger than I am.
And was he into sports too?
He was initially, and I think a lot of that was kind of the big brother syndrome. I always gravitated towards sports, and I think when he was really young, he looked up to me and kind of wanted to follow in my footsteps, but found out probably by junior high that sports were not his passion and was not something he was very good at. And he'd say that even now with a chuckle. And then he started to carve his own path and really fell in love with music, with graphic design, with art. And then around that time, the transition into computers being the big thing. So he currently does all the production for my video work, for my podcast, does all my graphic design. So it's kind of neat to see how everything's come full circle. Just in our lives.
Very cool. And growing up, what were the values, morals, lessons that you learned from your parents? What were some of the key ingredients? Because you started by saying, yeah, I was very lucky, very fortunate to have two educators. What were some of the things that they educated you on?
Well, just always do what's right. Like, don't worry about what other people think, what other people say, or even if anybody's watching. We've raised you to know what's right and what's wrong, and you need to always choose what's right. And I think, again, it wasn't just them teaching that, it was them modeling that, which I think as a parent is even more important. Because at some point, we all, and my children, well, you'll kind of tune out your parents, what they say, but unconsciously, you're always seeing what they do. And then again, my parents had a very strong work ethic. I mean, I'm obviously biased, but I feel like teachers are grossly underpaid given what their job is in society. I mean, basically raising future. So we're very middle class. So in order for me to have a pair of Jordans or to go to a camp down in North Carolina, I mean, my dad would work second jobs. He'd paint houses or he'd, you know, cut grass. He would hustle to make sure that he could provide a life for my brother and I that maybe he didn't have when he was younger. And that's certainly an attitude that I have as a parent. You know, I'm not super into material things. I'm very big into experiences. And even though I had everything I can think that I'd ever wanted as a child, I still want to try to pave an even better path for my own children and hope that they'll pay that forward to theirs.
So there's two things I hear when I hear you talk. Number one is valuing goodness. Hey, do the right thing, character, goodness, which we're in the business of trying to help people be great.
Yeah.
But I think oftentimes we as a society aren't focused on goodness enough.
Great
and
point.
I think your parents instilled that in you at a young age. Like, hey, being good matters. And I think as a society, we still need to value goodness because I think we have put greatness up on a pedestal and we're in the business of helping people be as great as they can be. And there's
Absolutely.
Nothing wrong with that, but there's also tremendous value in being really good. It sounds like your parents were just really good people.
Absolutely.
And then the second part of that is your dad also instilled this idea of going toward greatness and understanding that money does matter, that, you know, earning more income can help your family have different opportunities and different experiences that might be really useful and helpful in their life by taking on second jobs and doing extra things. So you use the word hustle.
Yeah.
What does that word mean to you today? And what did it mean to you back then?
Well, here, and I'll say this though, and you bring up some excellent points. And I say this with all due respect because I love my parents very much. They worked unbelievably hard, but I don't know that they worked very smart. Mm. And I say that with full respect. I've always had the entrepreneurial bug. I've always had this capitalist mindset. Now, I've always known to do what I love in order to chase that dollar. But I didn't get that from my parents, at least not directly. I may have kind of learned that adversely.
Where and how?
Well, there were two things that I remember, and I need to have this chat with them to see if they had any strategy or if they did this by accident. First was, my father is very frugal and doesn't like to spend extra money. He could never understand why I needed in air quotes, $120 pair of Michael Jordan shoes when $30 shoes, you know, from Walmart would suffice. So the deal was always, you know, if you want Jordans, we'll pay what normal shoes cost. And if you want Jordans, then you need to earn enough extra money to pay the difference. Like, we'll make sure you always have shoes on your feet, but we don't have to be buying $120 pairs of shoes. So I thought, oh, if that's all it takes to get Jordans, sure. You pay 60, I'll work my butt off to raise 60, and I'll get the shoes that I want. Same thing happened when I turned 16 to get my first car. My parents said, whatever money you save, we'll match it. So basically every dollar you save is like having $2 towards a car. I mean, I don't know if anybody listening is a math major, but, you know, you save up $3,000, you can get yourself a $6,000 hunk of junk. Well, I loved that. I saw that as a challenge and a great way for me to go out and mow lawns and shovel driveways and get a paper route and do things that, you know, folks of my age were doing because I loved the idea of being able to kind of control my own destiny and have the things that I wanted to have. Now, of course, when I was younger, I was much more into material things. I wanted Jordans and I wanted a car, you know, probably didn't embrace the experiences as much as I do now that I'm older. But that's why I've basically always been self-employed my entire life, because I love being in a commission-based job where my hustle determines the things that I'll have and the benefits that I'll go. And back to your original question, I think hustle is intentionally leaving your comfort zone in a variety of different ways. I mean, whether it's physically, mentally, or emotionally, it is a way to go above and beyond what regular people do. And you're again, I don't prefer the word grind. For some reason, that's always had a negative connotation in my head. And I'm like, I don't want to be grinding at something, because if I'm grinding, then maybe I don't love it. But I love the word hustle. And, you know, I think of some of my favorite players in the NBA. Steve Nash is one. I mean, he was an excellent shooter, unbelievable ball handler and passer. That dude hustled. That dude will get on the floor and dive for loose balls because he just absolutely loves to play. So to me, hustle has a very positive connotation. Grind has a little bit of a negative connotation, although they're probably very similar in definition.
So I'm going to unpack so much there.
Please do.
We're going to have some fun.
Awesome.
Because you're speaking my language.
Cool.
First off, my family growing up, we weren't allowed to have Jordans. And to be honest, we could afford it. But saying no was important to my parents. And I grew up in Potomac, Maryland. Look, it's an affluent area.
Yeah.
Not to say that everybody is affluent, but it's certainly people had material stuff. And from a very young age, my parents said no. Whether I was the last of my friends to get a cell phone. In high school, I was a senior in high school, and I still didn't have a cell phone, so I even remember writing numbers on pieces of paper, and sort of shows my age around that. But no, we couldn't get Jordans. But I think it's so interesting that your parents took that sort of materialistic thing and made that something that was actually going to drive you and start understanding the importance of working hard and earning your keep. And I think my parents did that in other ways, but I think that's just fascinating. And since you mentioned Jordans, like, I can remember wearing the Grant Hill Fila shoes.
Yeah.
Like, those were the shoes I wore. And I don't even know what they cost or what the Jordans cost.
Right.
But that's just such an interesting thing. And then the grind piece, I really want to unpack, because
please,
that is exactly what I say. I don't like the word grind. And golfers use the word grind. Soccer players use the word grind. Hockey players use grind. Akon uses the word grind. Like,
yeah,
the word grind has become this word that we just use, and it's a cool...
supposed to be like a badge of honor.
Yeah, like,
to say that you grind 24/7.
Who wants to grind through life?
No.
You said that. Like,
yeah,
that's exactly what I say. So I often talk to my athletes and my clients about the difference between grit and grind. And the Memphis
Love
Grizzlies
that.
Use them together, but I agree with you. I don't think the goal should be to grind through life. I think you wake up one morning and you're 90 years old and you've just grinded and you haven't taken any time to be with your family or your friends or experience different things. So to me, the grit is a different component than grind is. And grit has its barriers too, because I actually think there's a time to quit.
For sure.
And I don't think we value quit enough, because if Mark Zuckerberg just kept being grinding at Harvard and being gritty at Harvard, maybe he doesn't quit to go start Facebook.
Well,
that's
said.
Not to say that everybody should quit Harvard. I wasn't going to Harvard anyways, so it wouldn't matter. But I love what you said, and I think the difference between grit and grind is I'm putting my head down and knocking my head against a wall over and over and over again. Someone who's gritty is going to say, all right, is there another way I can do it?
Yes.
Is there a smarter way I can do it?
And I'm
like
going to stick
said.
With this, yeah.
So I think there's a distinct difference, and I argue with coaches all the time because they are the biggest users of that word grind. Hey, we just got to grind this out. Let's grind it out. And I use the analogy of a pencil. Like, you have a sharpener and you're just taking a pencil and you're just constantly jamming it. And eventually you're grinding and the pencil sharpener is going to jam. And now you can't function with it. Whereas someone who's gritty is going to find a way to do it the right way, get the technique down, and make it happen. So I love that you brought that up.
And I also find grind to be a short-term solution, not a long-term strategy. That, of course, there's going to be times in my life, personal or professional, where I may have to grit my teeth and grind through something. I'm not saying that life is all roses, puppy dogs, and ice cream at all times, but for that to be your long-term strategy, let's just wake up and slave away every single day, just grind and bear it. That's just no way to go through life. And I think people always, whether you're talking athletes or entrepreneurs or parents, will always do their best work when they're inspired, when they're, you know, the opposite of grind. And that's, again, see, hustle's a choice. I choose to hustle because I love the rewards that come with hustling. Now it's become a part of me. It's in the fabric of my DNA that I only know how to hustle because I love it. And yeah, I don't ever want to be... yeah, completely submissive to the grind.
Yeah, submissive. I was thinking a slave to the grind.
Yeah.
And that word slave is a strong word.
Of course.
Submissive is a strong word, but I agree. I think a lot of athletes specifically, but not just athletes, like investment bankers, people working on Wall Street, doctors, lawyers are grinders.
Yes.
And they wake up and they're 50 years old and they've got money.
Right.
But now what?
But they're missing out on things they can't get back.
100%.
And a couple quick thoughts. I mean, one, that entrepreneurial mindset, I remember vividly, and I don't remember how old I was, when I was cutting the grass one time, and I think the going rate might have been $20 for a pretty decent-sized yard in the Gaithersburg area. And I remember thinking, well, I'm cutting this lawn. I could probably have four other people cutting four lawns, and I make $5 off of each of one of them. They make $15, and I'd be getting $20 right now, and I'm not mowing anybody's lawn. Okay, there's a time for me to work smarter. And it was never about shortcuts or that I didn't want to put in the manual labor and work. I've had tons of jobs. It was, is there a better use of my intelligence and my resources to maximize this? So I could have an army of people out cutting grass. And I never had a lawn care business, just to make that clear. But I could have an army of people out there cutting grass, and I could be making more money than if I was actually doing the labor myself. And that's what always started me thinking on being able to scale, being able to develop teams, being able to get other people to buy in and provide them opportunities. So again, this entrepreneurial mindset, I think really... yeah, kind of set me on fire at a young age. And even though basketball and performance work and now leadership training, those are my platforms, I've always been an entrepreneur at heart.
So you were able to conceptualize that from a young age, which is pretty impressive. And we'll get more into your journey, but this stuff's just too good to just gloss over.
I love it.
But where was the fear? Because you have two parents who are in... God bless them. Like you said, they should be paid way more. Being a teacher is a gift, yeah, and is something that is valuable. And anyone who's been through any school knows that and appreciates that. But I would imagine, you know, they took a quote unquote safe route.
Very
when
safe.
It comes to how am I going to provide for my family? And yeah, your dad's doing these things on the side, but let's call it conservative.
Yeah.
What in your story allowed you to have the fearlessness to go for it? Because one of the questions I ask clients who are always interested in getting into business for themselves is I always ask them, do you want to work for yourself?
Yeah.
And if they don't answer that right away with a yes,
yeah,
I always tell them, it's probably not for you, because it is hard. It is difficult and it's scary, and you're going to have to take leaps of faith, and there's not someone writing a check for you every 2 weeks or
absolutely
every week or whatever it is. So what was instilled in you to have fearlessness, and maybe that's the wrong word, but how would you encapsulate that concept of being able to go for it and go work for yourself?
Well, I think that's accurate. Well, because my parents provided stability and security for me I obviously lived with them all through high school and then went on to college. I was able to dabble in certain things where it's really low risk because I didn't have a mortgage to pay for. I'm 16, 17, 18 years old. So I'm able to try different things there's a safety net underneath me because my parents provided that for me. And I think I just kind of conditioned myself and built the confidence to know that when I graduate from college, when that safety net is gone, I'm still going to be fine. I haven't fallen off the tightrope yet, even though there was a net. Now when it's gone, I'll be fine. And I'll be completely honest, you know, and you'd kind of reference something with your family. I knew that in my first few years out of college that if things didn't go well, my parents would still be there to catch me. I never once thought that I'd be homeless, that I would be starving. Now, I've always been very independent and very prideful, so I didn't ever want my parents to have to do that. But if I'm being fully transparent, that was always in the back of my mind. So it was never, I'm not walking across a tightrope that's connecting two skyscrapers, and if I fall, I'm done. So I think that also allowed me some freedom. But with that little bit of freedom, when I would dabble in certain things, then I would start to get confident and start to believe that I can do this, and then I don't worry about it. And I'm so programmed now, I realize that in all of my businesses right now, I mean, if people stop paying me tomorrow, I'm out of business. But that's never crossed my mind because I believe in what I do. I believe in serving people. And I couldn't be anything else but self-employed.
The tightrope.
Yeah.
I use an analogy all the time where I say, you know the guy who walked across the Grand Canyon without the net? And I always say, on one side of that tightrope is fear of failure.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to have a little fear of failure, because if he doesn't have that fear of failure, he's just going to run across that tightrope.
He's going to be complacent.
And he's going to fall.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he's just going to fall off that tightrope because he doesn't respect the tightrope. But on the other side, he has to have fearlessness. And so, you know, what I always say is you should fear failure when you're preparing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's really valuable when you're preparing, like, this isn't going to happen. I'm going to make sure I'm going to do everything I can. But then when we step on the stage or the tightrope, that's where it's like, okay, I'm fearless. And I'm just taking it one step at a time and going forward. So I love that you brought up the idea of a tightrope and not having a net. Because that dude literally didn't.
No.
And he has to balance fear of failure in his preparation and make sure that he's preparing with that fear and the possibility of winds or a bird coming in.
For sure.
And he has to be prepared for those things. But when he steps on that tightrope, he needs to be solely focused on, I'm fearless, on just taking this one step at a time. Because if he's now starting to think about the fear of failure, oh crap, I could fall and die.
Absolutely. And so it keeps them sharp.
It's what keeps us sharp. And I think that's the same thing for an entrepreneur. And what you talk about, it's like, look, I know I've got a net. I know I'm not going to go hungry. And by the way, we're privileged to have that, right?
Like, of course.
I don't use the word privilege
often. Don't take that for granted.
But yeah, I mean, living in this country, you are automatically privileged.
Yes.
You just are. And people come from different economics. But if you go to India or you go to places in South America, you will see a different level of safety net.
Yeah.
So, yes, I think that has to be pointed out. But a lot of people have that safety net and still are unable to use it and leverage it to go do whatever the heck they want. Why do you think what's like the – if you could pinpoint like one or two things as far as – what gives you the confidence to go do that? What would you say those things are?
First of all, I'm passionate about what I do. And any time in my life, whether a child or adult, when I've been very passionate about something, for whatever reason, I've done fairly well at it. I mean, because when my heart's in something and I care enough about it and go back to hustle and I hustle to earn whatever it is that I'm trying to achieve, I have a pretty decent track record. So I think that confidence, again, slowly started from my parents being so loving and supporting and providing that security. It's kind of like, learning to fly for the first time. Now that I've spread my wings and seen that I can fly, I feel good about that. And, you know, I do wonder, and I'd love your perspective on this. Sometimes I'm curious whether or not that security and that safety net has actually hindered me from achieving much greater success. Because I'll tell you, sitting here right now, I mean, you use the word privilege, and I think that's a very accurate word. I've never hit rock bottom in my life. I mean, I've gone through a divorce. I mean, I've gone through some things that I wouldn't categorize as wonderful or pleasant, but I've never been homeless. I've never had a major rock bottom moment in my life. And I know that there's so many successful people out there that have. And I've heard quotes, you know, the depth of your struggle determines the height of your success. And I often ponder, have I not reached a higher level of success because I've never tasted more pain, more failure, more disappointment? Have I never fallen off a tightrope and smashed my face, which has caused me to climb up even higher? I don't know. And I'm not asking to go through a rock bottom moment. I have a wonderful quality of life right now. I love my life and I'm beyond thankful for the privileges I have. But that's one that keeps me up at night. When I hear about somebody that goes from homeless, you know, to running a $500 million company, I'm blown away by that. And I'd love your perspective on it.
Well, I'll give you mine and then I want it to be a back and forth.
Sure.
Because I think you have an interesting perspective as well. So I've gone to the NBA Combine and the MLS Combine where I've interviewed athletes on the mental side of performance and then told an NBA team and an MLS team, like, hey, this is this guy's mental makeup. I think one of the biggest mistakes that NBA and MLS front offices will often make is assume that just because somebody grew up in a good environment and, came from maybe a secure environment, that they're not hungry and that they haven't faced adversity.
That's a good point.
So I use Stephen Curry. I use Kobe Bryant. I mean, these guys came up good families, right?
Yeah.
Like,
they had money.
And they're gritty. They're tough. They have faced adversity. And my perspective on it, the simple answer is I don't think that.
Okay,
And here's why.
I love it.
I think it's more linked to gratitude than anything else. So I think you don't think you've hit rock bottom, but someone else might have gone through a divorce and think that they couldn't recover from that.
Oh, okay.
Someone else might have been fired from a job and not come back from that. Someone else might have grown up with two teachers and looked at it as they're a victim because they weren't able to get the Jordans.
Gotcha.
So to me, gratitude is the separator. So I don't think Steph Curry was ever complacent because his dad played in the NBA.
Right.
I don't think Kobe Bryant was ever complacent because his dad played in the NBA. I think instead they were grateful that they had their dads in their lives, and they were grateful that they were open to these opportunities. And I really, like, I believe there's three types of people in this world: victims, survivors, and thrivers. Victims say, why me? Survivors say, it is what it is. And thrivers say, watch this.
Mm.
And I think gratitude is linked to complacency, when in fact they're inverse of each other.
Very true.
The more grateful I am, the less complacent I'll be.
Yes.
And so I look at your story as you're telling it, and you are super grateful for your parents.
For sure.
And as we get more into your story, there's going to be elements of gratitude. And so I don't personally believe that you do have to hit rock bottom. And for every one of those guys who went bankrupt, and, you know, Donald Trump went bankrupt at one point, and then
right. He's
president of the country, which we don't need to get into.
No,
on this
we will
podcast.
Not.
but, you know, there are those examples. And then there are other examples who took a family business. And, you know, we talked about Gary Vee off air. Like, Gary Vee took over a family wine store, I believe.
Yes.
And, you know, it's a mom and pop store. He grew that thing. And so was it that he hit rock bottom, or did he take something and was grateful for it and expanded on it? So that's my perspective on
Excellent
it.
Excellent
points. And I think gratitude is so valuable. And I think it's valuable in cultures, because when you have a culture of gratitude, then you have people that will do whatever it takes to be successful because they're grateful for the opportunity. And look, we both, I think, believe that complacency is the enemy of success.
For
complacency
sure.
will, it'll crush you.
Yeah.
And there is no part of your life where you probably pinpoint and say, yeah, I was complacent for an entire year. There might have been, or correct me if you think that. Do you think that?
Because
he gave me a little look.
I did give you a look, and only because I'm trying to think how long did it last. But I can absolutely pinpoint 2 points in my life where I was bit with the complacency bug. And I'll also say I believe gratitude and humility are closely linked, very much so. And they're also the opposite of getting complacent. And I think the one time I got complacent was probably after my junior year in high school. I was a pretty good basketball player. Now, I say pretty good as in my small pond of Montgomery County, Maryland, public school basketball. I was an okay player. So certainly not on a macro level. But I kind of had that feeling that I had arrived. As a junior, I was a pretty good player in the county. So why would I not be great as a senior? And I definitely got that complacency bug and stopped working on my game. I mean, I didn't have quite the senior year that I probably was capable of because of that complacency. And of course, lots of times complacency comes from a place of arrogance. It's, I have arrived. I was good last year. I think I can just put on the cruise control and I'll be fine again this year, instead of being thankful for the opportunities that you have and the people that are supporting you, instead of having the humility to say, I had a good junior year, but boy, I want to have a great senior year. So I do think those things are linked. Kind of early in my adulthood, I think I hit some complacency in the training. Like I got busy with clients very quickly and I loved what I was doing. And again, kind of put that on cruise control. I don't remember how long either one of those last, but I do remember those kind of being roadblocks. And those were times where I lacked humility, I lacked gratitude, and I definitely was complacent.
So we'll get back to your story because I want to dive into that. But I want to find out what you were like in high school. So you gave us a glimpse into what you were like junior and senior year. What were you like socially? What were you like as a human being outside of basketball? And then, give us a little insight into what you were like as a basketball player.
You know, what I find interesting, and I don't know the answer to this because I've heard people say different things. People always assume I'm an extrovert because I do like talking and like being around people. And that's always been true, even high school. But I actually recharge and energize when I'm in solitude and I'm by myself. Like when I'm done doing a speaking engagement for 500 people, I can't wait to get back to my hotel room and get away from everyone. And that's no offense to the people that I was with. I love serving people. But for me to be at my best, I need to be able to recharge in solitude. So I remember there being a balance of that and even some confusion in high school where, you know, again, with humility, I was one of the more popular kids. I mean, I played basketball. I was, you know, I sat at the cool table at lunch. I mean, I was very fortunate to have some good friends and would go to parties and so forth, but always remember being conflicted because there were times where I just wanted to be by myself. I wanted to be in isolation and never really had an appreciation or an understanding of that. Like, well, why don't you want to go to the party tonight? Because I don't feel like it, to be honest. I'd rather just be by myself. It's kind of an antisocial, weird way to approach something. Now that I'm older, I appreciate that. And I respect the fact that there'll be times when I'm on and with people and serve those people to the best of my ability, and other times where I just want to unplug.
Introversion and extroversion is the classic case, and there's more and more research coming out about ambiversion, where you're a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just a great article written by a guy named Todd Cashin, who's at George Mason University, who writes awesome stuff. And he talks a lot about situation. And we in psychology have not taken into account situations. So are you humble or are you humble when you're preparing? Because those are two separate things. Because if I'm humble in game 7 of the NBA finals, I don't know how good I'm going to be.
Right.
I need to be confident.
Got to have some ego for sure.
So I'm a big believer in you might be extroverted when it comes to the lunch table at school, but maybe you're introverted when you need to prepare for a workshop. And I know exactly what you're talking about because I give a workshop and I am so present and so alive and engaged. And literally people will come up to me afterwards and I am spent.
Yeah.
And they want to talk to me and engage. And I'm just like, you know, I just need to go drive a car or just like sit. And I even sometimes will black out for like some of those workshops because I'm just so engaged. And then I'm like, all right, it's done. So I know exactly what you're talking about. And I think one of the things I work on with clients, and I think it's an interesting concept with you as well, is it depends. Like, it depends when I need to be humble and when I need to be confident. It depends when I need to fear failure and when I need to be fearless. And I think, I believe, and I'm curious to get your thoughts on this, as a performance coach, I believe what you need to prepare from a mental standpoint is completely different than what I need to perform. So if I'm working on my shooting, and I'm specifically working on, you know, three-point shooting off the dribble, and I'm doing like the Russ Westbrook, you know, pull-up three-point shot.
Yep.
I need to be really specific about the technique. I need to be, you know, almost perfectionist. I need to make sure I'm doing it exactly right, that I'm landing a certain way, that my wrist is snapping, that the elbow is tucked in, whatever those things are.
Yeah.
That needs to be right.
Absolutely.
But when I step on the floor and I'm going against, you know, LeBron James or whoever I'm going against, now I need to just trust my instincts, trust my training, and completely go away from that perfectionism. And what I see, and I'm curious to get your thoughts because you've been around some of the best athletes in the world, is a lot of pro athletes struggle with taking their preparation mindset and parking it in preparation. And a lot of them struggle with taking the leap to go into a performance mindset. And one of the guys who I thought was the best at this was Ray Allen, who was like OCD and was so into his preparation and had to be a certain way and routine and perfect. But the moment, you know, if Ray misses the first five shots, he's shooting the sixth.
Of course.
You know, it's, there's no doubt.
And you can't convince him it's not going in either.
So give me your perspective on mindset for preparation versus mindset for performance, what you've seen, how you've seen it, and how you make sense of that.
Well, yeah, I think you touched on it right there. I think it's the rituals and the routines and the discipline someone has during the unseen hours that are going to give them that confidence to trust that training when the actual lights come on and the cheerleaders start dancing. I really think confidence only comes from one thing. It comes from demonstrated performance. Right. At some point, you have to actually do it to feel confident. Other than that, I think there's a lot of false bravado in sports, you know, guys that are acting confident, but they're not. I mean, and you would know this better having been inside the, you know, the brains of so many great players. When it's game seven and there's 3 seconds left and you're down one, how many guys really want the ball versus how many guys are like, please do not pass that to me? There's a lot, every single one of them acts like they want the ball. They act like, you know, give me. There's only very few that want it. And Ray Allen would be a guy that wants it because Ray Allen has, quote unquote, taken that shot a million times in practice and has been able, like you said, to use his muscle memory to trust the training and the process and just let that flow, you know, with fluidity once he's on the court to play games.
I love what you said. And wanting the ball is using your self-talk to say, no, yeah, I'm good. I want that ball. And by the way, understanding that self-doubt doesn't discriminate. So
right.
I can have self-doubt, and that can creep in, but Ray's going to say, dude, I've taken this shot. Just snap your wrist. You're good to go. So how the dialogue he's having with himself is where that confidence lives. And to your point, it has to be based on reality.
For
sure. You could fake it, and you might get away with it, but true confidence comes from, I put in the work. I know what I'm doing. I know how to do this. And then the ability to talk to myself, to tell myself, yep, I'm good, Ray. Like, let's shoot this. Let's make it. You're good. You missed your first five. So what? Let's get back on that. And that's the internal dialogue and understanding that the self-doubt will creep in and those thoughts will creep in, but I can shift the conversation, the dialogue, and the story that I tell myself.
For sure.
And that's just massive. Take me to college. So you play some high school ball. You go off to college. What's that experience?
I played basketball down. It was Elon College at the time. It's now Elon University down in Burlington, North Carolina. And it was a great experience, to be quite honest. Now, this wasn't as much from complacency, but I got really burnt out on basketball after my freshman year. I just didn't enjoy the game. I mean, I lived a pretty protected and sheltered life in high school. I didn't drink. I didn't party. I didn't chase girls. I didn't do any of that. I mean, again, my parents were both educators. They kept a pretty good watch on me. So when I got to college, I wanted to experience all those things. I mean, I joined a fraternity. I was out probably drinking way more than I should, chasing girls, the whole nine. And basketball became so much less of a priority for me. I really lost the love that I had developed as a child. And it took I still stayed on the team because basically my parents said, look, basketball is paying for your education. If you choose not to play basketball, then you pay for your education. So I was like, okay, then I'll just look at it as a job. And it's funny, I didn't use the terminology then, but basketball was a grind. It was, I got to go to practice every day because this is how I'm paying for schooling, but I don't love it anymore. And it took a little while for me to get the love back. And to be honest, I don't think I really got the love back until a couple of years after leaving college when I started doing the performance work for basketball it completely reinvigorated me. I got the juice of helping kids that reminded me when I was their age, when they were 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, and how much the game meant to me then. So, I mean, basketball has been a very high passion of mine ever since. But it's interesting that you'd think when you play college basketball, you'd be at the peak of your enjoyment for the game. And for me, it was the opposite for kind of the reasons I just mentioned.
Was the purpose for you in high school to play basketball in college, was that driving you in high school, or was that relevant?
It was definitely a driving force. And then because I wasn't, I mean, I'm not getting calls from John Calipari or Coach K, then it was, I had to make the decision, did I want to go to a bigger school and give up playing basketball and just be a normal student? Or did I want to cling to playing basketball and go to a smaller school? Elon was Division II when I went. They actually changed to Division I while I was there, and they're Division I now. So it's like, all right, do I want to be a Division II basketball player at a smaller school that most people had not heard of versus being a normal student? And that weighed on me, and I don't regret the decision that I made. I'm glad that I made it, and I'm glad for every part of my journey. But it was definitely a driving force early on, and then, yeah, there was some ambiguity as I started to finish high school. Like, is this really what I want to do?
And growing up, how important was education? Because we haven't really talked about it, but both parents are educators. How much was education stressed in the household, homework, getting grades, that sort of stuff?
It was stressed a lot. And what's interesting is I have a completely different mindset on it now. See, I don't think schooling and education are synonymous. I think they can be, but I can tell you right now, unequivocally, the vast majority of my personal education has not been from school. It's been from mentors. It's been from reading. It's been from experiences. It's been from quote unquote the hard knocks. It has not been, I took a class on this and someone prepared me well for what's going to take place. In fact, and again, I say this with full respect to the teaching community, I think there's a lot of fluff in the curriculums today at every level, from college down to elementary school, things that are not preparing people for the real world. I mean, why, what you specialize in, psychology and mental toughness, why is that not taught in elementary, middle, and high school as a formal class? And I'm not saying, you know, learning history or geometry is not important, but as far as what you'll need in the real life, one, to be present and to be able to do the things that you teach, how is that not something that's taught at every level? How is financial literacy not taught at every single level? How is self-awareness and building quality relationships with people not something that's taught? How is leadership not taught in schools? It's, you know, all right, well, you're a senior, Brian, so you're going to be our team captain, so you're the leader of the team. Really? That's good enough? That's not good enough. How is someone not teaching you the skill sets needed to be a influential and impactful leader? These should all be classes that are taught. Now, it's beyond my scope of the human psychology to know at what age is it appropriate to start formally teaching these things. But, you know, to be able to graduate high school or college and not know how interest rate works or mortgages or not know the key tenets of it's completely unacceptable. So I do think on some level, schooling is failing us. And if you put all of your eggs into believing that the only education you can get is from formal school, I think you're going to miss out on a lot of great learning opportunities.
I agree with you in a lot of ways. The good news is I do think it's changing.
Good.
And here's why I think that.
Good.
Number one, I was at George Mason University the other day. They give every single student the Strength Finder assessment.
I love that.
And so they get their strengths, they learn their strengths, and then every kid there has to take a meditation class. So,
love that.
So they're getting there. At University of Maryland, they're integrating philanthropy and the idea of doing good and teaching kids how to be philanthropists and that we all should be thinking about how we can give back. At Churchill High School, which is across this, you know, across the street from where we are now,
yeah,
and where I went to high school, I have a client who is a basketball player there, and he said they just had a mental health day where nice. The whole day was around mindfulness, and literally, it, like, the kids are there, and they're learning that. Tomorrow, I'm doing a two-hour workshop at a school talking about mindset. So,
awesome.
So I think it's getting there, but to your point, it's more of these sort of one-offs. It's more of sort of people going rogue,
right,
and creating their own curriculums. I have a good friend who is a high school teacher, and she just started doing mindfulness in her class every day. And she's an English teacher.
Love that.
Every day for 5 minutes, they would do some sort of centering or meditation or mindfulness. And over time, the kids started to just, that's what they do.
Yeah.
And so she's now taking that and teaching other teachers how to integrate it into the school system.
I
do think it's getting there. But to your point, what we grew up with, we weren't taught that.
No.
And, you know, I would add on to it, which the two that you didn't mention, which I know are you're probably very passionate about are nutrition.
Oh, of course. Right? Yeah.
And strength and conditioning and taking care of your body.
Just wellness.
And wellness, right? Yeah. And it's overall wellness. So I think you're right. And I think you're also right on the idea of, like, if you think that school is where you're going to get educated, I think you're missing out. I think you're looking at it from the outside in rather than from the inside out. And I think when I went to school and I got something, it was because I opened my mind to the ideas and I started questioning and I started learning and I started going outside of what the curriculum was asking and reading and watching videos and grabbing coffee with somebody.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, one of the first things I did when I finished grad school was I met with you.
Yeah. I remember it vividly.
I reached out to you and you're like, yeah, come on out. And I just sort of picked your brain about what do you think the local area is like? And, you know, I think people that do that end up learning and growing. And
for sure.
So I think you're right on that. There's so much learning, both formally and informally, that you can do. And to be a lifelong learner is so valuable.
Yeah. And you need to learn to find your passion. I mean, I tell young people all the time, find what you love, find what you're good at, and then find where those two things intersect. That's going to be your sweet spot. And, you know, I hated reading in school because it was someone else telling me to read a book that I had no interest in. I didn't become a voracious reader until a few years out of school when I was like, wait, I can read anything I want? Okay, well, I'm going to dive into this genre or these types of books. And now I love reading, but I didn't like it in school. And I think, again, giving kids more opportunities to make their own decisions, to have some ownership into what they're doing, to allow for more free play. To me, that is one of the biggest issues with folks our age raising young children, is every minute of every day is structured in their lives. And I don't do that as a parent. I have so many times where I just let my kids just have free play. And sometimes they just stand there and look at me like, well, what do you want me to do? And I'm like, well, you can just stand there for an hour if you want, or you can use your imagination. You can play, you know, go play tag, go climb a tree, go draw a picture, do something. Not everything has to have adult supervision and rules and referees and jerseys. Just go play and you'll learn how to work with other people. You'll learn how to negotiate. You'll learn, you know, all of the different things that we would learn growing up just going out and playing. And, you know, on some level, I've always felt technology is a gift and a curse. I mean, we're very blessed for the things that technology can provide, but it also alleviates kids that just go ride their bike to their friend's house, knock on the door and go play tag football for an evening and just make sure you're home for dinner, which is how I grew up. And I think there's a lot of value in those types of things. And I think even that type of stuff can be built into a curriculum, like a free period. But it's not a time to be playing on your cell phone. It's not a time to, you know, go play hooky or anything. It's you have to find something you're passionate about, and you can work on whatever you want during that free period, and we'll find resources for you. If you love art, you can work on art. Alan, if you want to go in the corner and do push-ups, you can do push-ups for an hour. Find what you love to do, and this period during the day will be to help support that.
I love what you said, because I agree. I think if we go to any commencement speech in the country right now, they'll say, do what you love, and Billy Joel was my commencement speaker at Syracuse, and literally all he said was, do what you love and love what you do. And
boom.
And like, yeah, that's simple, but you also have to be good at what you do.
Yes.
You know, and we were jokingly talking about before we started the podcast about being a stand-up comedian or a rock star and how that might be exciting. And like, I know I couldn't be successful at being a rock star. Now, maybe I could have learned an instrument and been pretty good at it, but I don't think I would have been that good. So your talent matters. So I don't believe in this idea like you can be anything you want in this world. Like, no. You have to be good at it too. Yeah. So you have to figure out what you're good at and figure out what you love. The other thing I was going to share with you that I think is really interesting, a friend of mine is a psychologist, and his whole practice is around letting kids develop curriculum. So he's someone I might connect you with, because he's like, we need to let kids develop curriculum. And when they develop curriculum, then it's going to be a more successful curriculum. And so he's really big into educational psychology and letting kids develop curriculum, which is fascinating. And the other thing that just really hits home to me is the notion of, you know, passion plus purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And when we have passion and purpose, that can carry weight. And I'm curious for you, because it sounds like the passion in basketball and maybe the purpose left you for some time while you were in college. And it might have been because maybe that was a time in your life where you were exploring different things, and mm-hmm. it was good for you to go party, and it was good for you to explore that. I think people that don't always have those opportunities maybe do those at a later stage in life, and maybe it's not the right time for them to do that. So I believe, like you said, there's no regrets there. Like, you know, my college experience, the way I always explain it to people is I always say I was really good at staying in the moment. Mm-hmm. So good that I didn't have a job when I graduated college. But what ignited the passion for you again once you graduated to be back into the basketball world in a different capacity? What was it that was the fire for you?
I think it was the youthfulness of starting to work with middle school and high school age kids that reminded me of me when I was that age, when I absolutely lived and breathed basketball and loved it. And I think that helped jar it. It also, I was always a one-off of just basketball because I fell in love with the performance side. And I remember even in high school and college really being into the strength training and the conditioning because that was something I had some control over. I always could control how good a shape I was in on day one of tryouts or of practice. So I kind of fell in love with that and found that, you know, as just something neat to try to tackle. So it was my refound love for basketball with my newfound love of performance work. And then, of course, having my parents kind of instilled in me that giving back to young people and serving young people is a great, fulfilling job. So being a role model and having an impact on kids meant a lot to me. So I was able to combine the old-found love of basketball, the newfound love of performance work, and the altruistic love of serving and helping young people. And that was my sweet spot. And because I'd always loved basketball and been decent enough at it, had really fallen in love with the performance work and studied that as much as possible, I was fairly good at what I was doing. I've always been a people person. I've always been a fairly successful communicator and motivator. So I really did find what I was good at mixed with what I really love to do. And that's why I haven't looked back.
You went towards teaching, which is the cool thing. You went to being an educator. Was that something you did, like hit the ground running when you graduated? When did you come to the realization that you wanted to be in the performance space, and how did you do that?
Well, it's actually funny. So I didn't know what I wanted to do when I was going to college. So I knew that my parents loved their job. So I just by default said, you know what? I'll be an elementary education PE teacher because I just love sports, and I'll coach basketball. That was the goal going into it. And I think it was end of sophomore year, I was doing some type of student teaching. And I was in an elementary school class, probably like sixth grade, and they had to do a project on leaves. They had to go out and find leaves and laminate leaves and label leaves. And I remember standing there going, I don't give an F about leaves. There is no way I'm going to spend the next 30 years of my life pretending that I care about leaves. I literally left that class, went right to my advisor and said, I cannot be an elementary education major. I have to find something different. This is not what I'm supposed to do. And he gave me the same question. Well, what do you love to do? And I was a workout fanatic at the time. Now, I wasn't doing it so much for performance on the basketball court because I was burnt out. I was doing it because I wanted to look good in a wife beater tank top and look good on the beach. But I was still very much into the strength training and the conditioning and the nutrition. That was a big part of my life. And I said, well, that's what I love to do. And there really weren't a lot of viable jobs in the late 90s doing that. The closest job was a quote unquote personal trainer, a fitness trainer. And I just started thinking, well, if someone can be a personal fitness trainer for moms and dads, why can't they be one for athletes? And again, there were strength coaches that worked for teams, but there were not a lot of individual people doing it. And I just thought, why not? Why not give this a try? I mean, Tim Grover was definitely the most renowned, Michael Jordan's trainer, Kobe Bryant's trainer, and I give him full credit for kind of legitimizing the industry. But he was like the only one I could even think of at the time that was doing it in the private sector. So
were you
aware
of him?
Yes, aware of him. Hadn't met him or didn't know him. But I was like, you know what? I see all these personal trainers at the local health club, and they're working out all these moms and dads before and after work. Why can't I be a personal trainer for high school athletes? And that's what I kind of just walked into.
So
and
this is
late 90s.
You graduated from college? And you
I did graduate from college.
Let's do it. Like I'm gonna...
And again, that's where I kind of had that safety net. I moved back to this area, which is where my family was still living at the time. You know, at the time, I can get an apartment with a friend in Germantown for hardly anything. I can eat peanut butter and jelly and ramen noodles, you know, twice a day. It didn't cost me a lot. So I figure if there's ever going to be a time to take a leap and go into a commission-based, unproven business, this would be it. And if I try it for a couple years and I can't make any money, then I'll get into something else. And I've always got my parents there to support me. They're, you know, the safety net under the tightrope. And turned out I could build a pretty thriving business. And in fact, when I first started, trained a ton of kids from Churchill, from Whitman High School, and naming high schools local here in the Montgomery County area, and absolutely loved it. And I was training athletes of all sports. I didn't really specialize in basketball for a few years, but I was training soccer players and football players, and it was awesome, and I absolutely loved it and was like, okay, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. Now I just got to work on my craft.
What was lonely about that process? What was maybe some of the speed bumps when you were just starting out? Just share that experience with us.
Well, I didn't have any business background. I mean, you know, thankfully I've always been somewhat blessed with common sense. And I just realized, you know, you can probably run a good business if you serve people, you treat people right, you charge them a fair amount for what you're worth, and you over deliver on what you're giving them. And that was kind of, those were like my business principles, but I didn't really know how to build or scale a business at that time. So most of what I've educated myself on over the last decade has been more on the business side, not as much on the performance side, because I was so heavily skewed towards learning the performance stuff very early in my career. But those were certainly some challenges. And, you know, especially early in my adulthood, was never really good with money. I could make money, but I never could keep it or invest it. I was always spending it rather foolishly.
You needed your dad to take some.
Literally, that's exactly what I needed. But I enjoyed it, and I just loved the process. And it was funny because, so when I'm first starting, I'm 22, 23 years old, and I'm training 18-year-olds in high school. I'm not that far removed from them. So one learning experience was, look, you need to provide a service. You need to be the adult. You're not their buddy. You're not their pal. And that was a very blurred line for me. I mean, because I would talk to them about inappropriate stuff during training because I was young, naive, and immature. So we're using bad language. We're talking about things we shouldn't be talking about. Now at 41, there's a clear age difference between an 18-year-old and myself.
They remind you of that. Yeah, you forget.
Exactly. But it's easier for me now to feel like an authority figure when I'm working with a high school age kid because of the age separation. That was really tough for me when I was younger. And it's funny now because, I mean, I'm 41, which means some of those 18-year-olds are now in their mid-30s. They're getting married, they're having children, and I remember training them when they were a wide receiver on the Churchill football team. So it's kind of neat to see the way things have come full circle. But I would say lack of business acumen and lack of the maturity to separate myself as the authority from the players I was working with were probably the two things that I didn't do a great job of, but I learned eventually.
So you're heavy on just finding individuals, getting in with anyone who wants to train, get better, get stronger, get more fit. You're working them out. Walk us through the other iterations of your business as it continues to grow and evolve.
Well, part of me took kind of the Nike model. I remember reading something on Phil Knight that said, you know, I can pay 20, this is long time ago, these aren't going to be the same rates. I can pay $20,000 for a full page ad in Sports Illustrated, or I can give the best athlete a free pair of shoes and he wears them in a picture that's on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Which one's better for marketing and promoting? And I remember thinking one of the first things I need to do is find the best athletes in Montgomery County, regardless of sport, and get them to come train with me. Even if they don't pay a dime, I don't care. I need them to train with me because if the best quarterback at Seneca Valley High School comes in and trains with me, he's going to bring in 10 football players from Churchill that will all pay the full amount. So I would have kind of a stable of three or four really elite level players, and I didn't charge him anything, but they were kind of the cornerstone of my marketing, because what kid and what parent's not going to make the inference, well, if Alan trains the three best athletes in Montgomery County, he must be really good at what he does. I want my child to train with him. And that allowed me to build up some instant credibility probably before I even deserved it.
So you understood marketing pretty early in the process, and it sounds like you learned that from looking at probably one of the best marketers of all time. Oh, how does he do it? And yeah, how does he think about it? So you understand, okay, marketing matters. And I would also imagine there's an element of like, I had somebody tell me this maybe a year ago. They said, think about who you can give your services away for free to, mm-hmm. who can't pay for it. Mm-hmm. And they might not be able to afford it. And then overcharge, or maybe not overcharge, but then charge a premium for those people that can afford it and won't even think about writing the check.
Right.
So they said to me, like, the people that really, you know, have to think about the money, no, just give it away to those people. But then the people that they're not even going to ask how much it costs, that's who you need to charge a premium for your time, and it'll balance out, and you'll feel good about, you know, doing some good and
Absolutely.
Also doing well. And I think for a lot of people, the idea of doing good and doing well, they think they have to be separate.
Yeah, they're not mutually exclusive at all. No,
they go together. Like, the more well I do, the more good I can do. And I tend to actually believe that if you do well, you can actually do more good.
Right.
And I don't know how you feel about this from your parents' perspective, but you can do a whole lot of good, but not always do well.
Very true.
And so that's been a focal point for me. And I think I'm in the helping business, similar to you. And
yeah,
I think a lot of people in our business just focus on doing good. And that's great, like, God bless people.
Yeah.
But if you're not doing well, it's hard. You can actually do more good if you do well. So
Without
that push-pull is interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing that I came to realize, I mean, when you're training those high-caliber players, they open up so many different doors for you. I mean, It's amazing what those things can do because people want to know. I mean, right now, currently, I'm actually writing a book on leadership. And part of that book process is I'm trying to interview some of the best basketball players and coaches and best entrepreneurs. I mean, in the world, I'm not going after small fries. I'm going after like Tony Robbins type people for an interview. And understandably, one of the first questions they ask is, well, who else is going to be a part of this book? And until they hear names that are peers to them, they don't necessarily want to be the first guy in the pool with an unknown, unfamous author like myself. Same thing. You know, when you're in training, if you can walk up and say, well, you know, I work with Tywan Lawson and Kevin Durant. Okay, now we're open to you working with our team. And that's how I get into certain things. So like being able to work at Montrose Christian High School opened the door to be able to work at DeMatha. Being able to work at DeMatha has opened up more doors than I could ever, you know, claim or list on this podcast. Those things all help. And it's interesting because it doesn't necessarily equate to your value. I firmly believe that if I would have been the strength coach for Churchill High School instead of DeMatha, I still believe I'd be just as competent of a strength coach, but people wouldn't know me. It doesn't carry the same cachet as when you're with DeMatha. So again, I learned early on that if you can link up with folks that have that brand recognition and are really good at what they do, it will open other doors for you. And as far as doors opening up, once you're in the door, you got to be good at what you do. I don't ever want to devalue that. And I would never want to make it sound like my career is just built on, you know, a house of cards of just charading around. No, once you're in, you got to be good at what you do and you got to serve people. Because if you say, I train Kevin Durant and you do an awful job with him and he doesn't speak volumes about how well you do, that party's over. I mean, lights are off, everybody goes home. So I think it's really important to work on your craft, but realize that the way the world works, you got to get in some doors.
And what qualities do you think make someone good at what they do at your craft?
A commitment to service is number one. Like you have to care about the person that you're working with. You know, it's not about sets and reps and what exercise are we going to do. It's about what can I pour into this person to make them the best possible athlete that I can. It's learning them. What makes them tick? What motivates them? Not what motivates me, what motivates them? What things do they like versus don't like? People will inevitably be more successful and better at the things that they like. So if right now, if I'm working you out and you love lunges and you hate squats, both of them pretty much do the same thing as far as physiology is concerned. We're going to do lunges a lot more than squats because you like to do them. And when you like to do them, you'll give me a better effort and you'll have better focus. And when you have better effort and better focus, you get a better result. So that's kind of the secret to coaching. By letting you choose what you like to do, similar to how you mentioned kids building the curriculum, you're actually going to get a better result. And I learned that very quick. I think you have to be prepared. Like it's important. I always wanted my players to know that I worked just as hard as I'd expect them to work. Maybe not in the physical capacity, but I don't just walk up to a training session empty-handed and going to do something haphazard. I've prepared for our workout today. I know what you did last time, Brian. I know what our goals are going to be for this session. I know what things you like, what things you don't like. I know what your short-term goals are, your long-term goals. So I'm going to design a workout program that has some thought behind it, and I'm going to make sure one way or another you know that this is not haphazard. And that can just be the way we're conversing throughout the session. And I want to make sure that you know that I expect you to come to our workout prepared, meaning you're nourished, you're hydrated, you got sleep, and you're focused. And I'm going to come to the workout just as prepared.
You said something about the lunges and squats and meeting them where they are. I had a boss once, I was in sales, and they told me, don't treat others how you want to be treated. Treat them how they want to be treated.
I love that.
And it blew my mind. And ever since he told me that, and it's interesting because it was a job that I didn't love. And I look back and I'm like, oh, was that the best thing for me? Yes, because I got that one line. And I probably have other lines, but that one line has really changed my perspective on things because we're all so focused on treating others how I want to be treated. It doesn't really matter if you love squats.
Right.
It matters if they love lunges.
Exactly.
And, to your point about working smart, a lot of times I think working smart is treating them how they want to be treated. Now, a 16, 17-year-old kid, they might want to be treated in a way that actually doesn't get them to where they want to go.
Right.
So you need to combine where do they want to go and then how do I get them to where they want to go? And that's coaching.
Absolutely.
Do you consider yourself a coach, a teacher? How would you label yourself?
I would probably label it coach, but I always have felt that teacher is about as synonymous with coach as far as responsibilities are concerned. But since I've worked primarily with youth, I consider myself a role model. But definitely teacher, I think those things go hand in hand. And it's interesting because just talking about terminology, for the first decade, I always called myself a strength and conditioning coach. And then over time, realized I was trying to have an effect over more than just getting someone stronger and in good shape. I wanted to improve their balance and their reaction. I wanted to improve, you know, body composition and agility. And, you know, so I was trying to improve their performance, not just their strength and their conditioning. So, and I'm not saying I came up with that. I've had some other quote unquote strength coaches that kind of shared that mindset. And I said, yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. So I've changed the terminology over the last several years to being a basketball performance coach, which on some level I know you are as well. Just I deal more with body, you deal more with mind, but we're both about raising the performance of basketball in this case. And if you raise the mind, I raise the body, and the coach of the team raises the skill set and the IQ, well, then you've built the complete player. Those are the four pillars of building a complete basketball player, and they all go hand in hand. You can't have mind without body. You can't have body without mind. If you just have mind and body but zero skill or IQ, you're not going to be a very good player anyway. So these things all are interrelated.
It's so funny because I've smiled probably 1,000 times as we've talked, and no one can see that because they're just listening to
I can,
voices.
And you have a nice smile.
I know. I've worked on it. I've gotten more into flossing and brushing my teeth. My best friend's a dentist, so he just yells at me all the time.
Love it.
But like the word performance. So in psychology, we have done a bad job as a field separating clinical and performance. So the word psychology, we tend to think of clinical depression, bipolar. You know, there are a litany of issues that are clinical issues that by all means, there are great psychologists out there that are on the clinical side that save lives, that do honestly more important work than I do. I realize when I got into school, like, that's just not me. Mm-hmm. I really am not that into the clinical side. That's not where my passion is or my purpose, but I love the performance side. And there's a whole sector of people that are on mental performance side that are not in clinical. So I've had, you know, all kinds of different clients with a litany of issues that I refer out when they have a clinical issue.
For
because
sure.
A, I'm not qualified. Let's just start there. I'm not competent to handle that. And B, I don't want to. So between those two, it's like, okay, get this person some help. And the clinical people do amazing work. But the performance side, that is a side, that's what I'm obsessed with. That's mm-hmm. what I'm focused on. That's what I'm learning about every single second of every single day. And it's interesting as you thought about changing your name, because I think what I'm hearing is like, I didn't really have a name for what it is that I do. I was in the 90s. Grover was doing it.
Yeah.
And I was sort of blazing my own path in a way. And I felt similarly in my field. I was like, all right, some people call themselves a sports psychology consultant. Some people call themselves a sports psychologist, even though they're not legally allowed to.
Right.
And they get into all these different terms. I was calling myself a mental coach.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized, no, I'm a mental performance coach.
Yeah,
so I just sort of rebranded, because that word performance, you're spot on, you know. And for me, the mental, nothing's all mental. Like when a guy misses a free throw, it's not all mental.
Right.
Just like nothing's all physical.
Correct.
And nothing's all technical. They work together. They
yes.
blend together. They bleed into each other.
And they affect each other.
And they affect each other. So if my mind isn't where it needs to be, my skills are going to be off. My
for sure.
physical is going to be off. But if I, you know, am on 0 hours of sleep and I'm not eating, you better believe that's going to affect my mental.
Like, of course. Your cognition all, and everything.
Yeah.
Your reaction, no question.
And if I'm a baseball player and my swing, there's something technically wrong with my swing, you better believe that's going to affect my mental.
Yeah, now you're going to lose confidence because you're striking out.
They all work hand in hand. So that's one of the reasons I love talking to people like you, because I think anyone that's in the teaching space or the coaching space is in some way a psychologist. You have to be.
Yes.
Just like a coach, you know, Mike Jones at Tamatha has to be aware of the physical side of his sport.
For sure.
But that doesn't mean he's necessarily going to be a strength coach.
No.
And, you know, he has to be aware of the technical side. But that doesn't necessarily mean he can be a great shooting coach.
Right.
He may know enough. And that's, to me, like, the best head coaches surround themselves with people that are experts, whether it's
yes.
mental, physical, or technical, and let them really get into the nitty-gritty. Because, by the way, that head coach has to think about lineups.
Yes.
Has to think about, you know, how do I develop chemistry? How do I what are we running plays? What's our
right.
system? There's so much for them to gather. And I always say head coaches hire me not because they're so all about the mental side. They hire me because they want to win and they want to get better. And they realize that part of the game is mental.
And they have an appreciation for what you do and the humility to realize that they don't understand it to the grasp that you do. So it's better to bring you in.
And those are the best coaches.
Without question. And they're smart enough to know, and I know you've experienced this at PVI and I have at DeMatha, they need to hear from a different voice. Even if Mike Jones was as well-versed as I was in strength and conditioning, it dilutes his ability to be the head coach if he's also being the strength coach. And now he's going to be the mental coach. And now what's he going to monitor study hall? And then he's going to no, you Good spread luck. Yourself thin. Yeah, you can't do that.
But so a lot of coaches do that. And it's worth noting. So you hit the nail on the head. I have had so many head coaches say, yeah, we're bringing Brian in. He's just going to give us a different voice. That's it. Like, he's bringing us a different perspective, a different voice. But I think a lot of head coaches that won't bring me in, and I don't know if you've had experience with this, it's often because they want ultimate control of everything in their program.
Yes.
And I think a CEO, it's the same way. It's like, I want ultimate control. And they're living in an alternate universe when yes. they go through that because of social media, because of parents, because of friends. Like, there's no environment or circumstance you can create where you are going to control everything your players
and do. Nor should you want to. I mean, I had interviewed Tom Izzo this past summer, and he said something unbelievably profound, because you're talking about one of the game's best coaches, and here he is, the head coach, and he said a player-led team will always outperform a coach-led team, that his job is to create leaders that can lead themselves, not just follow whatever orders and demands that he gives them. And he would say that the best teams he's had, he's grown, but he basically said, look, I've been the same coach every year. We've been good and we've been bad based on the level of leadership of the kids, not necessarily of myself. And there's so much truth to that. So it's, I think whether you're a CEO or you're a head coach, if you have to control every aspect of your program or your company every second of every day, you still may be successful, but there's no way you're anywhere close to as successful as you're capable of being.
And what happens if you have a health condition like Steve Kerr?
Yes.
And like, Kerr is just fascinating. Look, they have the most talent in the NBA. No one's going to say that they don't. That's clear. But they're not skipping a beat right now because that team is self-functioning.
Yeah, and they've created a culture. I've always felt culture is what goes on when the head coach isn't there. That's what your real culture is. It's not what happens during practice when the coach is there. Of course, you better be on your tiptoes then. But how does your organization run when the CEO is on vacation? How does your team function in the locker room when the head coach hasn't stepped in yet? That's what your team is really made of. And when there's dysfunction during those times, your culture has holes in it and you have some problems.
That's beautiful. I love that idea. And I love, it's interesting you bring up Izzo. So, I mean, those that aren't into college basketball, like, I mean, Izzo is on the Mount Rushmore of college basketball coaches. And one of the things that his teams, they always rebound the basketball. There's an identity, there's toughness. And, you know, they're known for bringing out football pads.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, if you watch a game, you're looking at a lunatic on the sideline. If you don't know anything about Izzo, you're looking at him, get at his guys, get after him. And I've interviewed so many of his players at the NBA Combine because
they love him.
They love him.
Adore him.
And the reason I'm interviewing them is because they're good.
Yeah.
And they're at the NBA Combine. Like, I haven't run into one of his players that is like, yeah, you know, I just didn't really Izzo.
Right.
You know, they really revere him. And I think it's one of the things we don't always understand. We mistake the emotion that you see from someone like Izzo or someone like Coach K. Like,
yeah.
I mean, he gets after his guys. Or the coaches that we've been around locally, they get after their guys. What people don't realize is the relationships that they build.
Yes.
And then the honesty that they have with their guys and the authenticity that they have with their guys that allow them to do that on the court. Frank Martin's another guy. Like, you watch Frank Martin, you're like, whoa, this guy's crazy. Bob Huggins. But their guys love them.
Yes. Because they've built that credibility. They don't start acting that way towards the player the moment they walk on campus. They build that love and that foundation and that trust and that credibility first, which then allows them to do that. And I remember Frank Martin this past season said something like, why does everyone keep asking me about tough love? I don't know what tough love is. Love is when you tell someone what they need to hear, not what they want to hear. Love is when you discipline someone. And I think that's a huge misguided thought, that kids today don't want discipline. They very much want discipline, because intrinsically kids know discipline means you care.
Yeah.
That you're holding someone accountable because you care about them as a person, you care about their performance, and when you stop disciplining them, you've given up. I can't tell you how many times I've told players about, you know, don't worry about when Coach Jones gets on you. Worry when he stops getting on you. Because when he stops getting on you is when he doesn't care anymore and has given up. And that's not something you want to experience.
And I would pile onto that with the idea of constructive criticism is stupid. Like, the idea that it's constructive criticism, because nobody wants to be criticized.
No, of course
not.
They
want to be disciplined,
yeah,
but not criticized. find me a person that, oh, I love being criticized.
Right.
No, we're not wired. We're wired to be defensive when we get criticized. It's really just feedback, though.
Yes.
And if you can flip your mind to start saying, anytime coach is coming at me, it's feedback.
Yes.
And I'm choosing what I do with it. And we were talking about Jay Billis. Like,
yeah.
I'm reading Jay Billis's book, and he had to really learn that when Coach K is coming at me, he's giving me feedback, and then I'm going to choose what I do with it.
Yes. Because feedback's never positive or negative. It's however you internalize it. It's whatever you want to take it. You could give me a comment right now about how you think I'm doing on this podcast,
yeah,
and I can take that as however I want. If you say that I'm not doing as well as you'd like me to do, then I could take that as, wow, somebody that's an expert in the podcasting field has given me a window into knowing that I can improve, and I'm going to take advantage of that, as opposed to going, oh, maybe he's right. I guess I'm not very good at this. So it's all on how you internalize it. And I think that comes with maturity, but it comes with being disciplined by somebody that cares enough to tell you the truth. And that's what somebody like Tom Izzo does. And I think the more you love someone, the more you can discipline them, the more you can be hard on them. And it's almost welcomed because of that. And I think that's unbelievably important.
Love trumps all. And I also believe this notion of, you said internalizing it, the word I always use is interpretation. It's all about the interpretation.
Yes, it is. Great
word. So how do we interpret it? That, at the end of the day, if we interpret it as criticism,
yeah,
do we interpret it as constructive criticism?
Yes.
Or do we interpret it as feedback?
Yeah.
And so one of the things I always work with my clients on is, hey, take it as feedback.
Yeah.
And by the way, some of it might be crap.
Right.
Like, it might not be useful for you.
Of course.
That's up to you to
filter. But you have to filter that out without question. But think about this right now. And this is, I learned this years ago and I find it very powerful, that rejection is all based on interpretation. If right now, you've mentioned, you work with a lot of really amazing athletic programs here. I don't think you mentioned Georgetown. So let's pretend you go to try and get a job at Georgetown tomorrow. Well, at this moment, you don't have a job at Georgetown. If you go and interview them and for whatever reason, you're not a good fit, you still don't have a job at Georgetown. You are no worse off than you were today unless you take that as, I guess I'm not good enough. Georgetown doesn't like me. They don't think I'd add value. So you're no worse off. You're literally right where you were. So how have you been rejected? How have you been knocked down a peg? You haven't been unless you allow that to happen to yourself.
That's such a good point, and I'm glad you brought up Georgetown, because I have been rejected by Georgetown.
Okay.
In multiple ways, not just in sports, but in other ways. And I remember my first reaction, my instinctual reaction is they'll lose out.
Yeah.
Like mine is like, fuck them. You know, they are missing out on me.
Yeah.
Because I think I've got embedded in me like this confidence, this self-belief, and it's pretty unshakable.
Yeah.
So it was never like, oh, why me? Like, oh, like victim.
Good.
I never go to victim. But my DNA, how I've developed myself is to be like, F them, I'll show them.
Yes.
That has always been it. What I've learned is, instead of just going to F them, I'll show them, I've learned to say, like, okay, let's reflect. Why didn't they maybe do that?
Boom.
What could I do differently? How can I learn from this? And that's taken a lot of work, because I'm an emotional guy. So
yes.
I have in me like, all right, let's go to work. I'm going to fight.
Yes.
And I remember getting cut from my high school basketball team and being like, F them. They're lost. They're
right.
Not going to get the point guard. Sucks to be them.
Yeah.
And that was my mindset. And I've completely shifted it to be like, okay, maybe I'll reach out again. Hey,
of course.
What could I have done differently? How could I have been better? Is there anything I can do going forward? Hey, and I keep that relationship so that, you know, it's still alive.
Yes.
And now it's much more like, all right, watch what I'm going to do. I'm going to figure out another way and another alternative. And it's persistence and it's resilience.
But it's because you hit it so perfectly. It's figuring out the why.
Mm-hmm.
When you lose a basketball game, you need to figure out, did we lose because we lacked effort? Did we lose because we lacked execution? Did we lose because simply the other team was more talented than we were? Did we lose? You know the game of basketball. Some nights the ball just doesn't go in. You take high percentage shots. Your team is in a flow. They're working hard. They're being unselfish. Some nights the ball just doesn't go in the basket. So how you lose and why you lose is extremely important. Same thing. I believe, like, I never want to miss out on an opportunity over something I can control.
Mm-hmm.
If I ever got feedback that, you know, because of my effort or my attitude or my preparation was the reason I didn't get the position, that's on me. And that would need to change. If I'm simply not a good fit because of something that I don't have control over, it still sucks, but I can live with that. As long as I'm controlling the controllables, then I feel I'm okay with whatever feedback I get. And same thing, if you happen to lose to a team that you know is better than you, as long as you played as hard, smart, and consistent and together as you can, you have to learn to live with that. And dealing with quote-unquote losses and adversity and not getting positions is all part of the fabric of what makes us who we are.
I go back to your question earlier in our conversation, which was just such a good, thoughtful question, which is, do I have to hit rock bottom in order to really reach my full potential? And look, pain is the best teacher. Pain is what shifts us. Like, you know, people will stop eating cheeseburger and fries if they have a heart attack.
Yes.
They'll stop smoking cigarettes if they get cancer. Like, pain does shift us. It does change us. But if you experience that pain, let's just use the Georgetown analogy again, and you don't take time to give that space and give it reflection, then that pain isn't teaching you anything.
Yeah.
And so I think one of the mistakes people make is they go through pain and they don't reflect.
And they just gloss over it.
And they just gloss over it and they move on. And look, we need that when we're in a game.
Yeah.
And there's a minute left in a game.
Yeah.
That's not the time to reflect. That's the time to be aware and say, all right, I'm still going forward.
Yeah.
But afterwards is the time to self-reflect. When we're preparing, it's let's reflect on it.
Yeah.
And then, so self-awareness and self-reflection are both very useful. Self-awareness when I'm performing, self-reflection when I'm preparing. And so that dynamic, I think, is massive. And I go back to that pain piece because you have to reflect on the pain.
But question, with what you just said, stirred a thought, but where does resiliency, even numbness and grit come in? Perfect example, now that I'm kind of new to this corporate speaking circuit, I'm applying for to speak at events, a lot of which are well above my head that I should be. So I'm getting a lot of quote unquote rejection right now. No, thank you. We don't want you. And to be honest, it's like I'm wearing Teflon. I don't even bat an eye. I apply. I didn't get it. Oh, well, when's the next one? And I've learned to be very resilient, kind of like your analogy with Ray Allen. I missed my first 5 shots. I don't care. Next one's good. I missed that one. Next one's good. Trust me. And so I do wonder, and I'm fascinated by your take on that, on when is it okay to just let these things bounce off of you? And when do you really need to do a deeper dive and ask yourself, okay, why didn't I get selected for this big conference?
Before I answer that, what are your thoughts on it?
I think it's both. I love having the resiliency. See, that's the thing. Right now, I apply to speak at a conference and I don't get it. It doesn't even change what I'm going to order for lunch, where someone else may have the same thing, and that might put them in a spin for 2 weeks. So I might just have a different barometer of what I'm considering rejection. I don't consider that a big deal because it's like a bus. I miss this one. There's another one coming within a few minutes, so I don't worry about it. Yeah. But I would agree, I guess maybe if I was applying to do something at Georgetown, maybe something more substantial, and they gave me some feedback. Usually when you apply to speak at a conference, they just simply say, thank you for applying. You're just not a great fit. Like, they don't really give you anything. If they thought you sucked, they don't tell you that you suck. They just simply say you're not a good fit. So you really don't get much to reflect on.
So, like, the Ray Allen analogy, let's just stick in basketball analogies, because I think that's the language we understand.
I sure do.
And so if people don't understand it, they're listening, sorry. I can't help you. But most people, and you probably find this, like, most people get the sport analogy, so
for
we'll
sure.
keep it simple. So what I always think about is, like, okay, Ray Allen misses the first 5. He should take the 6th. Why? Because he's super competent, because he's put the work in. He's done the reflection. He's worked on his shot. He's tinkered. Like, I saw an interview with Ray where he said, when I'm shooting shots by myself, I'm always trying to shoot off of an angle or shoot game shots. Or, you know, Kyle Korver is big into that, like game shots and trying new shots and new angles and getting hit and all these things. So I think they are sort of breaking themselves down and going to that humility in their preparation. But what I always said is, yeah, Ray Allen should shoot the 6th, but Josh Smith, he misses his first 5. He shouldn't shoot the 6th,
yes.
And he probably shouldn't have shot the first 5
because
he wasn't
point.
Competent at shooting 3s in the first place.
Right.
So I think it's understanding, am I competent? Yes, I'm competent. Why am I competent? Because I've done the humble preparation. Now, once I have a confident performance, I don't think there's anything wrong with going back to humble preparation again.
Right.
So,
good point.
Like, to me, like, one of the things I'll always, if someone says you crushed it, I will ask them, well, what feedback did you hear about why I crushed it? Or if I do a great job with a client, hey, what are the things that you find helpful? Because in my mind, there's one thing, but as we talked about earlier, meet them where they are, treat mm-hmm. them how they want to be treated. Because I might be saying one thing, but they interpret something completely different. Look, I'll give you a quick story because it's relevant.
Please.
When I was at PVI, like one of my first years, we were at St. John's High School. And the day before, I'd given a presentation on failure. And I talked about all these people who had failed. And that failure is really not anything. And it's, you know, it's just an experience. And so we're walking into the gym, and I walk up the steps and the stairs at St. John's. The kids go, hey, Brian, we're going to fail today. I'm like, oh crap, they didn't understand what I was saying.
Yeah.
And they completely didn't understand what I had said. And if I had just glossed over and been like, oh, these kids these days, they don't understand what I'm saying. They don't listen. No, they listened. They just interpreted it differently. So I had to rethink about how I think about failure and then how I deliver that message.
For sure.
And so to me, like, feedback is the lifeblood of performance. And it does help us grow. And it's where growth lies.
Yeah.
And so, like, the way to go back to the initial thought or idea, it's like, yeah, I think there's a time to say, it's good, let's keep going.
Yeah.
F it, I know what I'm talking about. And I have something that I'm working on now where I'm like, look, this is as good as it can be right now. I need to push this out there.
Yeah.
And then I need to let it and get the experience. And it's good enough that I know it's ready to go.
Yeah.
But if I stay in perfectionist mode, I'm never going to push
it out. No, absolutely.
So it's like writing. Like, you're in the process of writing a book.
Yeah.
Like, your book's never going to be perfect.
Of course not.
It's like a golfer. Their swing is never going to be perfect. A basketball player, their jump shot is never going to be perfect.
Right.
But it needs to be good enough that, you know what, let's roll it out and let's go. And so I think it's balancing, like, let's roll it out and go. And then also having the time to self-reflect and say, all right, what can I do differently?
Yeah.
So, like, when I got rejected from a program at Georgetown, you know, I emailed them after and said, hey, can you give me some feedback?
Yeah.
And they said, sorry, we don't do that.
Right.
But then I called, like, the head of the program and said, hey,
can you give me some feedback?
Yeah, like, some feedback on what do you look for? Like, what are the things that are important? And they did. And since then, I met with 6 other people who went through that program. So I know exactly what you're talking about, because so many people are perfectionist and they never put anything out there because they're scared and they're worried about being embarrassed, because fear of embarrassment drives so much in action.
For sure.
So I think that push-pull is so fascinating.
It
and
is.
We could go all day about that, because I think, to your point of what you're going through, it's I go through it every day. It's like, where do I spend more time on perfecting my craft?
Yes.
And when do I say it's good enough?
Well, it brings up, I mean, I'm a quote nerd, but I always love, I mean, the key to success is do more of what works, less of what doesn't. And I know that sounds so obvious, but how many times do people continue to do things that don't work over and over? And you only find out what works and what doesn't through feedback, either your own feedback loop or by asking for feedback from others. I mean, every time I give a presentation to a corporation, I ask for the attendees' feedback. And I've learned to throw out the outliers. If someone goes, this guy's the next Tony Robbins, okay, I'm not, so I don't need that. If this guy says, this is the worst speaker I've ever seen, he's probably had a bad day. It wasn't anything I did. Throw out those, and I look at the bell curve, and I start to look at, well, what things do people like about me as a speaker? Those are my strengths. That's my shooting if I'm Ray Allen. I want to keep pouring into my strengths. What are some things that they wish I'd do differently? Are those things that I'm capable of tweaking, and are they applicable for me to tweak, whether it's content or delivery, to give a more influential type talk? So that feedback's invaluable. But going back to the words that we started the day with, you know, having humility and having gratitude is all part of feedback. You have to have the humility to receive it, and you need to be able to show some gratitude when someone cares enough to give it to you. You have to care about someone to give them real, honest, raw feedback. And I, again, you mentioned also that as human beings, it's normal for us to be defensive when someone gives us criticism. Any type of negative feedback, the first reaction is always going to be a little bit defensive, but I've learned how to disarm that in myself and take all the personalization out of it. Now, I don't ever take anything someone says to me as a personal attack. They're looking at Alan as a speaker, either content or delivery. Here's my humble opinion of how he could get better. And I really appreciate when someone does that for me.
Is that something you've always been able to do, or is that...
Definitely not. That's rather newfound.
I sucked at that. Like, I can go back to my childhood. Like, my dad was a writer by trade, and
yeah.
I used to give him a speech and for him to edit.
Yeah.
Air quote edit.
Uh-huh.
Redline the whole freaking thing, rewrite the whole thing.
Yeah.
And ever since then, I'm like, you know what? I finish a paper, I'm just turning
it in. I don't
want
to show you.
And no edit. You know, there's so many grammatical errors.
Yeah.
This is Brian. This is my raw self. If there's
right.
a grammatical error, hey,
yeah,
that's
exactly
that's what it is. Oh, really, Brian? B minus.
Right.
You should have proofread this.
Yeah. Isn't your dad a writer?
And so I think it's something that you can absolutely learn. It's one
yeah.
of the things that I absolutely believe you can grow at, because I was so bad at taking feedback when I was younger.
For sure.
And now I'm mediocre at it.
But I'm sure it's getting better.
Oh,
a lot of people don't know this about me. In my 20s, I knew everything.
Yeah,
I really did. It's pretty amazing. I knew everything that someone could know when I was in my 20s,
yeah.
whether it was personally, professionally. So it's pretty amazing. And now I realize how much I didn't know then and how much I still need to learn now. But I think being able to depersonalize it. And, you know, that my high school coach was a pretty fiery coach. I played at Watkins Mill High School, and he would always say, like, I'm talking to your jersey. I'm not talking to Alan. Like, when I'm giving you feedback that you just made a bonehead play, that has nothing to do with your character or how much I care about you. As a basketball player, you just made a stupid basketball play, and I'm going to coach you on that. And being able to separate, I think, is crucial. And, you know, for me, that's what's been able to, the maturity and self-awareness and confidence in myself to be open to receive any type of feedback, positive or negative, by depersonalizing it has been unbelievably helpful just to my growth.
And that's for us, right, individually. But then I we've both been around great coaches. And to me, one of the things great coaches do is they deliver messages in a descriptive manner rather than an evaluative manner. Because an evaluation of you suck or you're great doesn't really tell somebody much.
No.
But a description of, hey, man, your footwork, like, keep that drop step. That's going to be dominant. You just keep working on that drop step. Let's go back to that. Or, hey, when you snap your wrist and your elbow's in, like, your shot is going to go in every time. The right. descriptions in the feedback is what's so useful. And just going back to how you use feedback in your own, it's the descriptions, right? It's
yeah.
when they tell you, hey, when you talked about Coach Izzo and, you know, how he – talks to his guys and the way he looks at the world, that really struck a chord with me.
Exactly.
In sales.
Yes.
That is great feedback. Whereas
note yeah, to self, Alan's I'm the next Tony Robbins. Right. That doesn't really do anything for me. Not at all.
So I agree with you. I think the descriptions are where it's at. We've been talking for a while. Really appreciate your time.
My
it's
pleasure.
Been super fun.
This has been.
Can you just give people some clarity around what you're up to now? It sounds like your business has started to shift. How has it shifted? What are you focused on? If people want to find you, where can they find you? All that good stuff.
Sure. Well, this has been a blast, man. I love talking about this stuff and really peeling back layers of just surface conversation and digging deep into the stuff we're doing. So this has been a lot of fun for me. I've spent 15 years, as we've talked about, as a basketball performance coach, and I'll always be indebted to serving the coach and playing community because that means a lot to me. I believe coaches, like teachers, are some of the most altruistic people out there because they give their time to help young people. And even though I'm 41, I remember being one of those young people that had a lot of people pour into me. So I'm eternally thankful for that. However, being a basketball performance coach does not drive me with the same passion that it did 5 or 10 years ago. So I've found in myself, as I'm trying to connect to my purpose, I need to kind of shift and pivot, pun very much intended with basketball, into something else. And I found that taking the life lessons and the stories, the firsthand stories that I've learned from Tom Izzo's and from Kobe Bryant's, and being able to share those with a new audience has been really invigorating to me. So while I'm still serving the basketball community, especially from a digital standpoint, you won't find me doing as many basketball clinics or workouts anymore because I'm serving more corporate organizations to teach, as you just mentioned. Maybe somebody in sales, maybe there's something I've gone through in basketball that can add value to that person's life in sales to help them lead a more happy and successful life, and that gives me a lot of fulfillment. So really, same story, same message, same philosophy, just shifting my audience. And so far, it's been great. But anyone that wants to follow the performance basketball side, which I still have a strong hand in, is just at Pure Sweat, puresweatbasketball.com. Anyone that wants to follow the new leadership and team cohesion and trusting the process and unseen hours type stuff, that's all Alan Stein Jr. That's the website and the social handles. And yeah, it's fun. I'm a guy that, as we've talked about in this, when I find and I really narrow my lens into what I'm passionate about, I mean, my quality of life goes up immensely. Like, I just love what I do now, and it's a new challenge for me. I've never had a corporate job in my entire life. You know, if you've listened to this podcast already, you know right out of Elon, I started doing basketball performance work. I'm going into an industry now where I have zero experience, zero credibility, zero resume. But I know absolutely positively with every ounce of my being that the lessons transfer. There's zero question. And that confidence is what is basically what I speak on and how I translate that message.
Here's why it transfers. You're in the performance space. I'm in the performance space. Everybody's in the performance space.
Yes, they are.
We're all performers.
And great call.
We might be a performer if we're a dad. We might be a performer if we're a mom. We might be a performer if we're in sales. We might be a performer if I'm a surgeon. I might be a performer if I'm a lawyer. Like, we are all performers in this world. It might not be in front of 20,000 people. It might be in front of 3 people. Or it might be I have to perform in isolation. But we're all performers. And that word, to me, is so powerful, and it's why there is crossover. And like, I got asked I did a workshop for a nursery, a landscaping company that does, it's called Rupert Nurseries, and they do all kinds of landscaping. And, you know, one of the people there said, well, how is this going to translate to our guys? And I said to them, they'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Because you're right. Like, I've never done work on a tree or planted a tree or done any work. You know, you might have been better at it than I have because you used to mow lawns as a high school kid. But for me, like, I knew very little about that field. But you know when you're talking to people if there's connection.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just talked about performance. And that's what you do. You're going to talk about performance. You've been around elite performers at every level. And you've been able to see how they work and observe and watch and ask questions.
For sure.
And listen and absorb. And that's performance. And
excellence and greatness doesn't – it transcends every industry. And yeah. Like you just said, it transcends every area of your life. And to me – you'd be foolish not to take some of these analogies and put them in your life. When you're in the sports world, now, folks in the sports world, they pull analogies from folks in the military, from folks in the business world. So it's not just a one-way street. A successful CEO could walk into the Duke basketball locker room and teach them just as much as Coach K would teach the employees of the CEO's company. So these things are completely inverse.
Yeah, you mentioned Kobe Bryant. I mean, when I hear him, he talks about Michael Jackson and the impact Michael Jackson had on his life. Warren Buffett, you know, they go outside of their sport. And I agree wholeheartedly with you. And the reason that I think that is because they know their sport.
Yeah.
You're going to go talk to, you know, people in finance. They know finance.
Yes, that is their sport.
They don't need someone to come in and talk to them about finance.
No, that's what they do.
They need someone to talk to them about how do I perform better, and they can connect the dots for you. So we're both in that same space in the sense of, like, I love – like, I use the Blue Angels all the time with my athletes. I talk about the Blue Angels. They have to fly these freaking planes,
man,
you know, hundreds of miles an hour, completely in sync with each other. Oh, what do they do to prepare? They visualize, they meditate, they debrief and get feedback, they use self-talk. These are all sports psychology tools. And actually, to your point, the biggest employer of sports psychology is the military.
Yeah.
They hire tons of people with sports psychology backgrounds, and they have this whole program around resilience training that they put their people through. So to me, that's the cool thing. If it was almost just about sports, I'd be kind of bored.
Of course.
It gets stale.
Yeah.
But when it's a bigger picture and it's about performance, to me, that's the fun stuff. So,
and you also hit one last point, and I've really embraced this, is you need to intentionally seek out people in different industries and outside of your normal lane and wheelhouse. I know that – now, I've been a public speaker for a long time. I've just only spoken at basketball events for most of that time. Now I'm spreading my wings a little bit. But I've studied the hip-hop genre and the stand-up comedy genre, which I know we talked about earlier, because both of the – I mean, they're both orators. They're both trying to convey a message. They just do so differently. And, you know, when you study a stand-up comic – first of all, who doesn't like to laugh? But I don't necessarily watch for the content. I watch for the delivery. I watch for their timing. I watch for their staging, their inflection, their tone, their body language. You know, if you can walk out on a stage with nothing but you and a microphone and make a room full of strangers laugh, that's an unbelievable craft and a skill that has to be developed. And even though my talks are not designed to make someone laugh, they're designed to make someone think. They're designed to make someone act. They're designed to make someone change their behavior. So you better believe that I approach my talks the same way Louis C.K. would approach his Netflix special on comedy. So why wouldn't I want to learn from that? You know, if you talk about a hip hop artist, you know, again, content aside, somebody like an Eminem or a Jay-Z who, you know, I mean, they're on the Mount Rushmore of hip hop. What they're able to do with the English language, the imagery that they can paint with their words, the way that they can bend, like, that stuff is magical. Why would I not want to learn from some of those different places? If all I studied were public speakers, I don't think I'd ever become the best public speaker that I'm capable of. So I try to learn from as many different people as possible.
And music and comedy are the ultimate performances. So they have to get on a stage basically naked, right? Like, they're basically naked. They're putting themselves out there. They're making themselves vulnerable. And by the way, like, I truly believe the biggest fear that humans have is embarrassment.
Of course.
We are designed, we are wired to stay away from embarrassment, because if we embarrass ourselves back in the day, we'd be kicked out of our tribe,
yeah.
And we'd be isolated on our own, and we'd die. So the same place where emotional pain lies in the brain is the same exact place as physical pain. So we are designed to stay away from embarrassment. It is absolutely, we're wired that way. And a comedian or a musician have to fight the fear of embarrassment.
For sure.
And so does an athlete, and
everybody
so does,
does
a salesperson, and so does a doctor or lawyer.
How do you handle that? I know you've been trying to end this podcast for 10 minutes,
and I won't
shut up.
It's your time. I can go all day.
Because I'll tell you what I do, and I don't know if it's a successful coping mechanism, but sometimes I just ask, what's the worst that's going to happen from this? All right, I'm getting ready to give a keynote talk to 500 employees at TIAA down in Charlotte. What's the worst that can happen? I go up there and absolutely blank, forget every word I was ever going to say, and I stand there like a fool and I sweat. That sucks. There's no arguing that. But I'll live to see another day. I'll live to do another talk. It's not, you know, it's really not that bad. And for whatever reason, that's always helped me. And I'm not acting like I'm impervious to embarrassment. I don't want to be embarrassed any more than the next person. But when I ask most of these situations, I'm not the guy that's walking across the Grand Canyon on a tightrope with no safety net. The worst that can happen to me is really not that bad. And for whatever reason, that gives me just enough comfort to not worry about it. And I'll also say this. I'm a polished public speaker, but I still get the butterflies before I go on, and I want to have them. I love to have them because I use that. I don't like to use the word nervous or anxious, but I use that energy to bring me to life and to have the passion. And the day that I don't get a little bit nervous before some of my talks is the day for me to move to something else.
I'm just smiling. One of my favorite quotes, and it's not... It's Beyonce. I'm nervous when I'm not nervous. If I'm nervous, it means I'm going to have a great show. And I think about Beyonce, and I talk about this when I do workshops. Here's this. She's sort of introverted. If you hear her interviewed, she's sort of quiet. But no, make no mistake. When she gets on stage.
Yeah, she's an independent woman.
She's kicking,
boom, boom,
right? She is kicking ass, and it is, she's Queen Bee,
yeah.
Right? And so to answer your question, the way I use it, first of all, I think 100%. What's the worst that can happen? When you have perspective on that, it's massively important and helpful. And athletes that have perspective on that, it helps them perform. For me, it's an understanding that feelings and thoughts have a shelf life. So I gave it.
That's good.
Right? Like that's passion and purpose don't expire. But feelings and thoughts have a shelf life. So I can remember. I was giving a workshop recently, and I started like getting physical, somatic reaction. Like my, you know, felt sweaty, felt tense. And I stood there and I'm like, well, I'm about to give a speech about how to perform under pressure. And I just sat there and I sort of interpreted those feelings and said, okay, it's normal. I'm okay. And I literally felt that. And no reason for me to feel that way, but I did. And I just sort of accepted it, acknowledged it. And a minute later, I wasn't feeling that anymore.
Nice.
I think one of the big mistakes that we make is to buy into feelings and thoughts.
They're going to last forever.
And they're going to last forever. And the reality is, like, we all have feelings that aren't useful.
Of course.
We all have thoughts that aren't useful. And the more you can realize that those are thoughts and feelings, and that action is sort of the way out of that, and, hey, I've got a feeling of being nervous, well, I'm just going to act and keep going forward. I just think that's the way to go. And when you can realize that feelings and thoughts are just feelings and thoughts and that you take the action, man, it's beautiful. And look, I agree with you. I get nervous. Like tomorrow I'm giving, a workshop at a high school.
Mm-hmm.
I've done workshops in front of 1,000 people or
right.
I've done workshops in front of pro sports teams that I can't sleep the night before because it's churning over in my head.
For sure.
I'm going to sleep fine tonight
right.
because I'm not worried about how I'll perform. But you better believe it's in front of 140 high school students. I'm going to feel some nerves
of
going
course.
Into there. But what I've learned is to accept those thoughts and feelings. And the second part of it is when you screw up. Like, I remember doing a workshop for GW's women's rowing team. I'll just tell this story because it paints the picture. And I'm talking to them, and I know very little about rowing. Sorry, I just don't know much about it. And I read Boys in the Boat, which is a rowing book and a great book, a leadership book, little plug for Boys in the Boat, great book. But I'm talking to them, and I'm going, all right, so when you guys are rowing, and for those who can't see me, I'm like going left to right, rowing, left to right, left to right. And they start laughing at me. And I'm like, why are they laughing at me? And we move on. And then I say again, yes, so when you guys are rowing, I'm going left to right, left to right. And one of the girls says, we don't go left to right. We go sort of north to south. Mm-hmm. And we do it with two hands in front of us. It's an oar, not a paddle.
Yeah.
And I had completely forgotten. And I was like, and I felt it, right?
Yeah.
And I had this feeling of embarrassment, of nerves. And I can feel that. And the thought is like, you idiot. But then I just sort of said, yeah, you know what? I don't know about this sport. I'm going to learn. That presentation was one of the best presentations I ever gave.
Awesome.
I didn't even get through. I have a PowerPoint presentation. I got to like slide 30 because there's a whole discussion about mindset and how we perform. So like to me, the understanding that thoughts and feelings are thoughts and feelings, we learn to accept them.
Yep.
And then we take action and we move forward and we move our feet and we keep going. And we come back to that moment and we be where our feet are. Those
yep.
types of things. I think that's just massive.
And the humble preparation will always help mitigate some of that nervousness. I mean, when you feel fully prepared, it doesn't eliminate it, but I think it certainly helps. When you've taken a million jump shots like Ray Allen and you know it's time to take the game winner, you're at ease, as opposed to a Josh Smith who knows that he hasn't put in the work and doesn't deserve the opportunity to be successful. So that's why I'm so passionate about getting reps, in air quotes, right now with my talks, because every time I get it, I get a little sharper at it. I get a little better at delivering it. I'm still going to continue to have those butterflies before I speak, but there's, I also know that once the lights come on, I'm good. And I know that even when I'm speaking, when I've given some of my best talks, and I'm sure you can say the same thing with the athletes you've worked with, everything seems to slow down. It's almost like an out-of-body experience. I remember I was giving a talk last week, and I kind of use a set list the way a musician would. I only write down a few words on a laminated card. I don't have notes. I don't have PowerPoint. It's just me and a mic, almost like a stand-up comedian. But because I'm still a little bit new at this particular talk, I just have some words to jog the memory of the story or the life lesson. And somehow I skipped over one and completely forgot it. And it's pivotal to the story. But I was in the zone where it was slow enough that I said to myself, Alan, you forgot number 3. Not a big deal. You can insert it after number 6. I'm talking. Never even paused. Didn't take a drink of water. This was going on in my head while the muscle memory of my mouth kept moving and saying my talk. And it was a euphoric feeling. I felt so controlled because no one in the audience had any clue that I forgot number 3 and that it's not supposed to go after number 6. Only I knew it, and it didn't rattle me. And it was a really neat... It gave me a high like none other. It was a really cool experience.
Right. So you're talking about flow state, right? The idea of being in the flow, things tend to slow down. It seems to be clear. We're really in the moment. We're able to process things. Great book, Flow by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. I'm not spelling it because I don't know how. But he's really pioneered this idea of flow. And it's something that I think everyone should read. Go back to like high school curriculums. Mm-hmm. They should understand what flow is, mm-hmm. What that's like, so we can be aware of it. But you hit on something, and we talked about stand-up comedians, and we talked about musicians. I love talking to actors, because actors, and I had an actress on my podcast.
Impressive.
Like, they, because their job, and this didn't really hit me until, I actually had a high school basketball player who was an actor. And he, to prepare before they got on stage, it was like 2 hours. Think about it, makeup. They do breathing exercises. They get their voice vocally ready. They go through this whole process. They get into costume. I mean, there's this whole process to get ready to go on stage. And he was just showing up to basketball games and just playing.
Yeah.
I was like, dude, what do you do for acting? He's like,
right.
Well, I go through all this. I'm like, so the next game, I see him on the bench, and he's doing some breathing exercises to get himself ready. And it helped him perform. But the thing about acting that is fascinating to me is – and I never thought about this because I never was an actor. But their job is to say their lines, be in the right spot, but not look like they know their lines.
Exactly.
And so like...
they have to know it so well that you don't know that they've memorized that they've internalized it.
Right? And they're the character.
And of course, in many instances, they're allowed to ad-lib a little bit. But for the most part, they have to say what they're supposed to say. That's why the writer wrote it in a specific way, down to the syllable. Yeah, I'm blown away by that. So they're not just memorizing lines. They have to memorize them and then convey them with the same type of passion that the character would. And let's not forget, they're not even pretending to be who they – I mean, they're pretending to be someone other than who they are.
Yeah.
Like, it reminds me of a Seinfeld episode when they were talking about kind of remaking Seinfeld, and they said, Kramer, you can't play Kramer. He's like, what do you mean? I am Kramer.
Right.
And that was hilarious. There's a lot of truth to that. I mean, think about that. If someone had a show and they wanted Alan Stein Jr. to be a character, I'm not good enough actor to play myself in an episode of that. That blows my mind how talented actors and actresses are. It's really revolutionary.
True, because they – so – this concept of like they can't anticipate the line coming, because if they anticipate it, then it's acting, right? Yes. It looks like acting. And we've all seen a movie or TV show where it's like, they're acting.
Yeah, they're overacting. We say it all the time.
Instead of being.
Yes.
Instead of being. And so at the end of the day, our job is to be.
Yes.
And so when you're given that presentation, you are able to be. And because you are competent,
yeah.
rather than feeling confident. So one of the things, confidence is a big word in my field. Everyone says confidence. I think competence trumps confidence. Because competence is about being. Confidence is about feeling. If we can focus on our competence and who we are, then the feeling of self-doubt or lacking confidence will eventually come, it'll go away, and we'll build confidence because we are competent. So you stood there and you knew you were competent and you knew you'd find a solution. And that to me is what an actor does. They're competent, but they are not necessarily anticipating what that person's going to say. They're instead listening and they have to react. And so we're both obviously interested in acting. And at the end of the day, I think what our both of our passions are about, what makes a great performer? What's physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, technically, what are the things that make a great performer? And we've come from different paths, but I think we're on a similar journey, which is cool. And I've really enjoyed chatting with you.
Likewise.
You're super generous with your time. I think one thing about Alan that I'll just throw out there, like, you know, this guy's got a lot going on. He, you know, is a busy body and probably similar to what you were like when you were 12 years old, skateboarding or doing whatever it was that you were running around doing. And, you know, one of the things I'll never forget is just reaching out to you sort of cold and saying, hey, do you have time for me to come in and chat with you? And so I'm forever grateful for that. It's been a while since we've met, and really enjoyed this conversation. And it's been seamless and fluid, and it's what I look for in these podcasts. And you said earlier, like, I love digging deep and going a little beyond the surface. And that's the whole idea of this podcast. That's why it's called Beyond the Surface. It's like, we can sit here and talk about superficial, you know, we can talk about Jordans, we can talk about video games or whatever those things are. But for me, getting with people like you and just picking their brain and finding out their story and finding out how we can continue that story is the fun part.
Awesome. Thank you. I appreciate you, brother.
Thanks, Alan.